good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson on this wonderful Monday. Thank you for being with us. You know, we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona on Monday on Jump in Tucson. There's so much wonderful stuff happening with research and student learning and student success and faculty success. And it is definitely the heartbeat of the city of Tucson right in the middle. And there's so many wonderful things happening. So we call this Wonder. And we talk to people who have been doing wonderful things at the U of A. And one of those people is Dr. Joellen Russell, who I met when she gave a presentation to my students, about 300 students. She had just come back from South by Southwest and had done a great presentation about oceans and so forth. So we're going to talk about oceans in the second segment. But welcome, Dr. Russell, and thank you for being here.
Ed, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you are the University of Arizona, a distinguished professor and the Thomas R. Brown Distinguished Chair of Integrative Sciences, and you're head of the Geosciences Department. You have a lot of responsibilities at the University of Arizona.
Well, I love it. Who wouldn't want to serve here? This is the best show in town.
That's great. So tell us a little bit about how you got to thinking about oceans and geosciences and how your journey of education and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Well, I'm a Big Red State kind of girl. I grew up in above the Arctic Circle in Kotzebue, Alaska until I was 10. My dad worked for the Indian Health Service, so I grew up on the ice and the snow. I know how to mush a dog sled and skin a seal with an ulu. But it's been, and after that, we moved to northern Montana. So when I interviewed here at the University of Arizona, long time ago now, as a brand new, you know, wannabe junior professor, I just fell in love. Tucson is so beautiful, and the mountains in every direction. You know, it's the biggest small town, the biggest small town I've ever lived in. It's huge, but you wouldn't know it, not from the people and not from the surroundings. There's a trailhead in every direction. Couldn't wait. I was just like, they've got to give me the job, honey. I told my husband, and he was like, oh, you want the job? I'm like, I want this job. This would be a great job. And you know what? You know, 18 years later, I love it. I'm living my best life here.
It's kind of funny that your research centers a little bit on oceans, and we live in a desert a couple hundred miles in every direction before we get to an ocean, but yet you're kind of an expert in oceans, and it's
robot
interesting.
Robot floats, supercomputers, and satellites. I use a lot of remote tools, but all my students go to sea. We do we deploy those floats, and we use a lot of satellite data, and then we do a lot of prediction, which is all numerical models. So we have a fantastic supercomputer here at the University of Arizona, which we've built, you know, from the ground up, you know, sort of stone soup style. You know, the university only puts in about half, and the rest of it is put in by other faculty, writing grants, staff, help, et cetera. And we're, you know, our supercomputer is bigger than Stanford's, and we built it right out here in the middle of the desert.
That's amazing.
Have you seen that mural at Speedway and Campbell? No,
yes.
It's Grant and Campbell, the great big huge. It's a Sonora. It's Joe Pagak. He did this huge, beautiful Sonoran landscape on the side of what used to be an old movie theater, and made these almost to life scale blue whales swimming through the Sonoran Desert. I love that so much. You know, oceans and deserts, we go together.
That's great. We're going to talk about oceans after the break, but could we talk a little bit about Science Moms and your experience there and the cool things that are happening there? If you could first kind of explain what Science Moms is and what your contribution is to that.
Sure. So Science Moms is a nonpartisan. We don't take donations. We're basically funded by a couple of very large donors. And we are a nonpartisan group of climate scientists who are also moms who wanted to get the word out in short, cheerful, basically little video snips, et cetera, that help explain what climate change is and how it's impacting us and what we can do about it in tiny videos that you could watch while you're sitting in the carpool lane waiting to pick your kids up or drop them off. And that has been, so I got an email from Catherine Hayhoe, who's in Texas, and she is a very famous climate scientist and communicator, who said, hey, Joellen, How'd you like to go in with me on this project? We'd be called Science Moms. You can check us out. We'd be sciencemoms.com, and we do this sort of outreach to the fellow moms and parents and grandparents and aunties and uncles and everybody about what we can do and how we can all prosper together and look after our kids. And I was a little hesitant at first because I don't, I'm a scientist, I'm a professor, et cetera. But I love Catherine and she's amazing. And so we went in on this together. So I helped co-found this sciencemoms.com, just this past week I was on the Weather Channel talking to, fellow folks about what how to prep for extreme weather, right? How to make sure you've got enough water, food, et cetera, on hand, medications. If you're traveling, if you've got small kids, there's extra additions to that. And so I had a segment on the Weather Channel just this past week because that's part of what Science Moms is all about, trying to get the word out about what's happening and what we can do about
And so this is a labor of love for you, Science Moms.
it.
It's part of a cool thing that you do for educating people. But you also are educating grad students and students at the U of A. You have lots of young people who's you're their mom too, in a way, because you're shaping
Oh, I
their
love
research
that.
life.
Thank you for saying that. That's so kind. And I hope so. Exactly. But I had 503 students in just one of my oceanography classes this year. And it's a hoot. We have the best, brightest, most amazing students here at the University of Arizona. And I love my job. Everybody keep getting that question, like, how do you do classroom management with such a big class? I'm like, what do you mean? My students are great. I have to tell them that, I like a noisy classroom. I like them to interact with me and each other. And they're like, no, we're going to be good and be quiet. I'm like, no, really, come on in. The water's fine.
That's great. An ocean of knowledge is waiting for them in your classroom, that's for sure.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
I love that you call this segment Wonder, because that's really what this is all about. I'm just helping them discover what their planet is, the life support system that keeps us all afloat. The way that the temperature is moderated and changes is all about the ocean, 72% of our Earth's surface. And teaching them, in a gen ed level sort of oceanography class about the life support system and how we use and enjoy our oceans, it is wonder. It is. And so I love it because while I'm, sort of a window to the past for them, right? They get to know all the things we've learned and how we got here and don't do this because,
Right.
they're sharks. They, for me, are the window to the future, where we're headed. And I look at them every year and think, we're in great hands and it's going to be fantastic. I just know it. Look at all these bright young people. Isn't it fantastic?
That's great. We're speaking with Dr. Joellen Russell. She is the head of the Department of Geosciences and an expert on being a mom, but also being a science mom, but talking about oceans. And when we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about National Ocean Month, which just was completed, and an article that appeared recently. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Wonder edition of Jump in Tucson, where we talk about the wonderful things that are happening at the University of Arizona. One of those wonderful things is my new best friend, Dr. Joellen Russell, who has done some amazing things for me and the kids over at the Eller College. She is the distinguished professor, Thomas R. Brown, distinguished chair of integrative science, and head of the Department of Geosciences at the University of Arizona. Welcome back, Dr. Russell.
Thanks for having me, Ed. It's a joy.
So, June was a month of each year to recognize how important oceans are in the world, how it affects humanity, and how it affects our biosphere that we live in. And so, you share your expertise all the time, but National Ocean Month was an important recognition of the important role that the oceans play for all of us human beings. So can you talk a little bit about being a researcher living in the desert and how ocean activity impacts people living in Arizona?
It's such a big deal. I got invited to speak at the National Science Foundation's Ocean Sciences Directorate. The people who do the oceans, who own our, who run our fleet of civilian ships, where we get to out to see our ocean and do all our measurements, et cetera. The National Science Foundation is so critical to this endeavor, and they invited me to be part of their National Science Foundation Ocean Sciences. Frontiers in Ocean Sciences Symposium, and I got to give a talk. And you can imagine there isn't another person at that symposium who lives in the middle of the desert.
Right.
But so that was a lot of fun and really amazing that there's national recognition for Arizona's role in tackling the frontiers that we are finding in ocean science. And the reason that is so important, the thing you actually asked me about, is that our desert doesn't have a lot of buffer. As the temperature changes, as we're going to longer and longer summers, and I know we're going to hit 110,
Right.
100 for about a week coming up here.
Right.
This is spectacularly hot weather for us. This isn't normal. This is literally 6 to 7 degrees above normal for this time of year. I mean, everybody says, "Well, isn't it always hot?" I'm like, "Not this hot."
Right.
And the issue is we don't have a bunch of huge lakes. We don't have a deep green rolling forest all the way across. I mean, saguaros, yes, but some pine trees, but really we're not in the taiga. We're not in and we also don't live next to a nice cool water current, which San Diego and others enjoy. So what we have is what the world average temperatures, as they increase, we're getting the brunt. We are the third fastest warming state in the nation. Tucson is the third fastest warming city. Phoenix is the fourth. And that means we're really sitting in the bullseye of climate change. And that actually turns out to be a good thing for the United States because we have outstanding expertise in both heat, desert living, adaptation, mitigation, meaning what do you do to help improve our carbon dioxide footprint? And that means I work at the best place to be working on global climate. And they need the oceans because the oceans are what is taking up about 93% of that. The energy imbalance for the planet is going into the ocean. So how the oceans mixes and stirs is absolutely essential to what happens next right here in Tucson.
So we've had a researcher on recently that was predicting the hurricane season, that there might be as many as 14 hurricanes in this season just because of the added number. And this year, what they think this is the earliest that
At five ever.
this early in the season for sure.
Yep.
And so obviously there's some impact on the oceans with climate change. Just to the casual
Yep.
observer, you could kind of surmise that. So this is important to kind of understand what climate change is doing to the oceans and how the oceans are responding to that.
You've got it exactly. We can see from satellites that the at sea surface temperatures have been warming, but that's not really what happens. Meaning, when you run a hurricane over the ocean, any water over 80 degrees is going to help that hurricane grow. The oceans have been warming. When I said they take up this energy imbalance, what that really means is the oceans are really warming. They're taking up a lot of heat, which is keeping it from warming us here in Tucson, but means that they actually are holding a lot of energy, and that energy can be released catastrophically in big hurricanes. The forecast from the National Weather Service was the most large hurricanes predicted ever in the history of the Weather Service this summer.
Wow.
And we had the earliest Cat 5 ever already, so their forecast is looking pretty good. And that's bad because it means that that extreme weather event I did with the Weather Channel just this week is on purpose because everybody needs to know what you need to have on hand just in case. Not for us. We don't have hurricanes in Tucson, but we do have big monsoon storms that can be very damaging, pull down power lines, shut off power. And particularly when it's warm, that can be difficult. So our oceans carrying all that heat means that normally when you run it across the ocean, a big hurricane, it sucks some of that heat out, forming a big storm, and that cools the surface. But what our robot floats are telling us is it's not just the surface that's hot, it's hot down 400 meters of water. That's four football fields. And all that heat is available as the ocean mixes up as you run the hurricane across it. So that's part of that prediction that the Weather Service did, saying that we were going to get a really, really rough hurricane season this year, is because our oceans are so hot, they've got a lot of gas to fuel that fire.
You're listening to Dr. Joellen Russell on the Wonder Version of Jump in Tucson. She is the head of the Department of Geosciences at the University of Arizona. So can you talk about some of your projects related to ocean heat and the carbon uptake that you're referencing here? What are you and your team doing to kind of see where we are, and how do you do that with robots and satellites and so forth? How is that all coming together?
We use robot floats because we only have so many ships and they can only be so many places at once. And while the satellites can see the surface, they can't see below the surface. And we need to know, is it 100 meters of hot water? Is it 400? How many meters? Because that's how much energy could be released, which is really serious for both our weather. A friend of mine said that all of the weather that'll wipe out your house comes from the ocean. And they're not wrong. That is very serious, and it's actually true. I mean, that's a colloquialism, but it's a science fact. So what is scary about this is that, so what we do, I have a couple of projects. One is we're doing better carbon accounting in the ocean. We want to know how much is going in and how much is coming out so that we can better attribute. So the U.S. reports very carefully what carbon emissions we have, and we've been reducing our emissions while growing our economy since 2007. We actually cut our emissions from roughly 22% of the total for the planet to 13%, and we're on track to be only 6% while remaining 22% of the global economy. So for you Eller folks, this is amazing. I mean, we're decarbonizing our economy while booming, which is stunning because it's not true for most of the rest of the world. So this is just making us more efficient and better able to grow in future because we won't be linked to some of this heavy industry oil and gas that might be with non-allies, I will say. I actually see us making huge progress here. And what we've been doing is using those robot floats. And what they do is they profile up and down. And every time they come to the surface, they beam the data back by Iridium satellite, these low Earth orbiting satellites, direct. And we post it both to the Global Telecommunications Service for weather forecasts, as well as just put it publicly, freely for everyone. So you can find out how much carbon the ocean's taking up, how hot the ocean is. All of that can be used in both our weather and our fish and other forecasts, you know, ecosystem forecasts, you know, coral reefs, danger from high temperatures, et cetera. All of that information is coming back from these robot floats. And we've been deploying them as part of projects I'm involved with for 10 years now. We just celebrated last week at Princeton our 10th anniversary of deploying floats. And the first batch of floats we deployed was actually off New Zealand. And I was there for a Fulbright fellowship last summer working with their National Institutes of Water and Atmosphere. And they have an atmospheric monitoring program for carbon. And they were finding that they were only seeing in the atmosphere about half of what they were actually emitting. So where did it go? They looked at the cows, they looked at the grass, they looked at the trees, they looked at the rivers. It's their ocean. The ocean around New Zealand is taking up a huge amount of carbon, about half of their total emissions every year. So their impact on the atmosphere is about half of what we thought it was. And we found the carbon using the robot floats over the last 10 years. So it's a new paper. We're submitting it just, I think, in the next week or two. It's pretty exciting.
Very interesting, yeah. So if someone wanted to find more about what you do and ocean science, where could they go? What could they do? They follow? Yeah.
If you want the short stuff, come to sciencemoms.com, you know, short and easy. If you want the longer version, you can come to the geosciences department at the University of Arizona, which is geo.arizona.edu. And we would love to see you. And, you know, I have a website there as well for with all of our research projects, you know. And of course, the project we're working with New Zealand is Carbon Watch New Zealand, which is pretty fantastic. My very dear friend, Sarah McAuliffe Fletcher, we overlapped back when I was at Princeton and she was a grad student there. And now she's the head of carbon in New Zealand for the whole country. So I am fortunate in my friends, fortunate in where I get to work here in Tucson. Such a fantastic time.
Well, we really appreciate you, Dr. Russell, and all you do at the University of Arizona, but also nationally and around the world to bring to light the joy that's the oceans, but also the challenges that we might have and what we as researchers can do to tell the world about what we need to do in order to make the oceans the wonderful, life-giving thing that it is for everybody. So thank you for being with us today on Jump in Tucson.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Great. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson on the Friday show where we share success stories, go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you, and maybe you'll be interviewed live on the air. We'll be back on Tuesday with Ted Maxwell, Wednesday with Grant Kruger, Thursday with Tom Moulton, and I'll be back on Friday with success stories. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice.
This is Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. Jump in Tucson's Monday theme is Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the University of Arizona, including student projects, student learning, student outcomes. Those are really important things. But we also celebrate top-level performances by artists and athletes, and especially top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. One of those scientists and researchers is Dr. Jack Holt. Good morning, Dr. Holt.
Good morning, Ed.
Thanks for being with us on Jump in Tucson. So before we get started in talking about Arctic glaciers, let's talk a little bit about Dr. Jack Holt and your assignments at the U of A. How did you get started thinking about being in geosciences or planetary sciences? And what was your educational background that led you to the University of Arizona?
Well, that's kind of a long story. I started out in electrical engineering as an undergraduate, but I loved studying the Earth. But I couldn't really see a way to combine those interests, and the job market was better for engineering. Yeah. But then I lucked out and got a job with NASA at Jet Propulsion Lab in California, and I discovered remote sensing, where you can put sensors on aircraft or spacecraft and use them to study the Earth from above. And of course, that applies to other planets. But at the time, I was really just doing interested in Earth science. So that led me to pursue geology and geophysics in graduate school at Caltech. And I started, you know, discovering how I can, you know, use my engineering skills to support doing science. That somehow led to me working in Antarctica, running big field campaigns, mapping the ice sheet and the geology underneath from airplanes. And that was a job that I held at University of Texas at Austin and it basically evolved into being a research professor there and eventually leading me to study ice on Mars as well when the NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter mission got to Mars and they added scientists to their team. So ironically, studying glaciers on Mars led me back to studying glaciers on Earth by looking at similar types of glaciers on Earth. And that led me to working in Alaska, which has all kinds of glaciers and is super interesting. So it's been a kind of a long, strange path. But 6 years ago, I moved to the University of Arizona in part to lead a new effort in Earth observation from space at University of Arizona, because we have such a great legacy of planetary missions and such great Earth sciences. Let's combine those and try to make U of A leader in Earth observations from space and suborbital platforms like aircraft.
Yeah, so I think there's a urban myth. I think it's true that every NASA mission since its inception has included someone from the University of Arizona, whether they're leading the mission or contributing like you did to the Mars mission. And so U of A has a long legacy of planetary science and exoplanet science and Bennu and all the cool things that have been going on recently. So you're a professor in planetary sciences, geosciences, and at the Lunar and Planetary Lab. So what are some of your responsibilities at the university now that you've been there for 6 years?
Well, I guess the classic professor responsibilities of teaching, advising graduate students, leading a research team. I have a postdoc and a part-time engineer as well. So I enjoy all those things. Of course, there's committee work in both departments. And then kind of layered on top of that is this Earth Dynamics Observatory, the effort I mentioned to bring U of A into Earth remote sensing observations. And so that spans, you know, that's a program that spans multiple departments and multiple colleges across the university, because unlike planetary science and astronomy at U of A, which are have their own departments and everybody is, you know, working together all the time, Earth sciences is very spread out at University of Arizona. There's people in, you know, College of Science, SNRE, CALS, optical science, all kinds of people who are doing work related to Earth science, but getting, I work to get them talking and collaborating to do new big things. So, I'm also, on the executive panel for the University of Arizona Space Institute, which is a new entity to support, people and groups across campus who are developing new proposals for space missions and instrumentation for space missions. And so that's kind of a complementary effort to what I've been doing with Earth Dynamics Observatory. So anyway, those are kind of all the, I guess that's the scope of the things I'm doing.
Great. So yeah. We're talking to Jack Holt, Dr. Jack Holt, who is a professor in planetary sciences and geosciences and lunar and planetary laboratory work with the Earth Dynamics Observatory. And so you've had a lot of experience with Antarctica. Now you're up in the Arctic looking at glaciers and so forth. So what are some of the differences that you've seen in the information that you have gathered since you were in Antarctica and then you were looking at Mars and so forth? Now you're back looking up north. What have you seen that has changed over the last 10 or 15 years? I know global warming is, some people don't believe that it's an issue and so forth, but you've obviously, we're going to get into how you're measuring some things up in the Arctic, but just in general, what have you seen over the last 10 or 20 years in terms of people's response to global warming and what you're seeing as a scientist?
Excuse me. That's a great question, Ed. Unlike Antarctica, which is so vast that you really can't observe change except from space, in Alaska, the glaciers are changing very rapidly. They're smaller, but that's still a lot of ice, thousands of glaciers, some very thick ones. They're changing fast enough that I can observe changes year to year, especially over the 10 or so years I've been coming up here and working. You see lakes forming in front of glaciers that did not have lakes before, with icebergs calving into the lakes. You see the glaciers, we've measured them thinning by repeat measurements flying over them. And sometimes it's up to, 10 meters, up to 30 feet or more per year of lowering of the surface. So that's a form of retreat people don't usually think about. So in addition to the glaciers receding back and lakes forming, they're thinning. So, and I think one of the most interesting things I've noticed is locals, people have lived here their whole life, and especially pilots. I work with a lot of pilots here, and I am a pilot. And, they've told me they've observed massive changes in their lifetime. And it's the kind of thing that just doesn't happen naturally. The rates of change aren't what would normally happen. So that's where I come in. I try to explain to people, hey, humans are causing this because we're accelerating the process in a huge way. We're, giving it a big kick in the behind, basically. So
let's take a break, and then when we come back, let's have you talk about how you're measuring that up in the Arctic and how you're seeing how the glaciers. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm Dr. Ed Ackerley, your host. This is the Monday Wonder Series, where we talk about the interesting things going on at the University of Arizona. One of the scientists who's doing research that is really important is Dr. Jack Holt. He's a professor in planetary sciences, geosciences, and also at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. Welcome back, Dr. Holt.
Thanks, Ed. Good to be here.
So We were talking about the Arctic glaciers and how, just in your own experience over the last few years, you've been able to year by year see a dramatic change, and other people who live up there and are working up there, pilots and so forth, have seen dramatic changes in their lifetime. And so, you know, that's anecdotal information that people can just tell you that it's different than it was. But as a scientist, you have to kind of validate those things by doing research so that you can actually say that for real, this is what's happening. And so you have been granted a $30 million grant from NASA to work on studying Arctic glaciers with airborne radar. So can you talk a little bit about that program of Snow for Flow and how that whole project is going to work and how you're going to be able to track those changes on glaciers up in the Arctic?
Absolutely, Ed. Yeah, this is a great opportunity I'm very excited about. I had a lot of people help develop the concept for this proposal. And it builds a bit on a NASA program that I was involved in over the past 8 or so years called NASA Operation IceBridge that was doing airborne measurements. And that focused primarily on using a scanning laser altimeter that would basically map a swath of surface underneath airplanes or flying over a glacier very precisely, giving you the height of the surface. And then we would repeat those every 2 to 3 years over each glacier to measure how much it's thinning. My specialty is more in measuring ice thickness with radar. So radar, you know, you might be familiar with weather radar that bounces, you know, energy off of particles in the atmosphere, tell you if it's raining, or police radar that tells you, you know, tells them how fast you're going. This is a similar technology, but the wavelengths are much, much longer, kind of like ham radio that bounces off the ionosphere. But if you basically point it down over ice, it goes through ice, and you can see all the way to the bottom and measure how thick the ice is. You can also use a higher frequency radar that's almost about the same frequency as your microwave oven. If that is directed down below an airplane, you can measure recent snow thickness. So like last year's snow accumulation, if you fly it in the spring. And it turns out that those two measurements you really cannot do from space. We do have a laser satellite now that can essentially do the laser repeat measurements we were doing from airplane, but there's really no good way to measure how much snow is accumulating at the top of a glacier, which is basically the input side, you know, into the glacier system, and then how thick the ice is. And so you don't know the volume of ice that's flowing through the glacier. You can't measure that from space. You can measure the velocity, so you know how fast it's going, but without having a cross-section of what the glacier looks like, you don't know the quantity of ice. And without knowing the snow input, you can't really assess the system. And so there are people who model glacier systems and try to predict what they're doing or will do in the future with increased warming. But without knowing the inputs and the outputs of the glaciers, you can't really accurately predict anything. They have some rough ideas of these things, but our goal is to fly over many hundreds of glaciers in the Arctic and get those measurements that we cannot get from space, and then put that all together and try to understand what these glaciers are doing and how much they're going to change.
So we're speaking with Dr. Jack Holt, who has an interesting program called Snow for Flow, which is a program in the Arctic funded by NASA, a $30 million grant. So this is important for people because of a couple of reasons. One, as you stated, need to make predictions about how glaciers shrink and grow and how they contribute to something really important, which is sea change level. And so there's been a lot of talk recently about how glaciers are melting and how the coastal areas are going to be affected by the higher seas. So this is an important thing that you're doing because it affects people's lives, affects commerce and business, and all along the coastlines all around the world. So can you talk a little bit about how your measurements of the Arctic change in the glaciers is helping people make those predictions of the rise in sea level?
Yeah, great question. You know, you hear a lot about Antarctica and Greenland in terms of sea level rise, and they are the big ones in the long term. Over, you know, hundreds of years, they will contribute much of the vast majority of sea level rise. But right now, today, the glaciers are actually changing the fastest. They're kind of like the canary in the coal mine. And even though they're much smaller in terms of overall ice quantity compared to Antarctica and Greenland, the big ice sheets, they are contributing about 20% of current sea level rise. So their contribution to sea level rise, you know, is vastly outweighs their total volume because they're changing so rapidly. So that's our focus, is like, let's try and understand these glaciers that are changing so rapidly, because they have the most immediate impact on sea level rise. And on, you know, in the Arctic, you know, you've got opening of, you know, the North Pole, you know, sea ice going away. That's kind of a separate thing, but it's also related. That you're getting big changes in ecosystems along the coasts. There are a lot of communities along the coast, and these will be affected by these changes, and they're already being affected. So it's kind of like, well, while other people study Antarctica and Greenland, and we can do that from space in a lot of cases, we're going in and targeting the glaciers that are changing fast, have the most immediate impact, and we cannot get these measurements from space. So that's why NASA liked this proposal, and it came together and is going to happen, which is very exciting.
How long will the program last? Will this be like 3, 5, 6 years, or how long will it go that you're measuring the size of the glaciers?
Yeah, so the overall program is really 6 years, but we have 1 year of basically preparation and planning and selecting the science team and instruments, and then 3 years where we do surveys in the spring. We're going to capture the previous winter snowfall. So we'll have basically March through May, like probably 2 to 3 month campaigns each in three sequential years. And then a year of assimilating data and producing papers and things like that. So it's basically 5 to 6 years total.
And in that time, the glaciers could melt more and there could be less this, or they could actually, some of this could be reversed if lots of magical things happen between now and then. So it's an interesting paradox of how do you predict what the future is going to bring?
Yeah, I think during that time frame, our measurements will enable better predictions for sure, and with a lot less uncertainty to go into the global models. And I think, you know, we're not really planning on doing repeats of glaciers. We're quantifying what's happening with an individual glacier over the course of a year.
Right.
And then we will repeat some areas, but it's mainly to get these parameters of what's the input and what's the output, so we can create a model for the glacier that makes sense.
Well, very interesting research up in the Arctic, looking at glaciers and measuring them with airborne aircraft. Dr. Jack Holt from the University of Arizona, we thank you for being with us on Jump in Tucson today. And good luck with your excellent research, finding out how glaciers grow and recede. And we thank you for being with us today on Jump in Tucson.
Well, thank you, Ed. It was really my pleasure, and I appreciate the interest, and happy to talk about it and spread the word. So thanks again for inviting me.
Great. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice.